Welcome to Passy Muir's CAM Podcast, Conversations on Aerodigestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guests, speech-language pathologists Marta Kazangian and Karen Dykeman, continuing their conversation on the role of the SLP from intubation to communication, part two.
I want to welcome everyone back to our Conversations on Aerodigestive Management podcast, where we're continuing our conversation with Marta Kazangian and Karen Dykeman. In this episode, we're going to be discussing communication and the role of SLPs in working with these patients and their needs. So we're seeing more and more in the literature about the need for earlier access to communication. Freeman Sanderson et al. They've published a number of studies where they've looked at the psychological impact on patients who do not have access to communication, whether that's because of intubation, tracheostomy, ICU interventions, sedation. But they found that those patients who did not have access to communication tended to have higher levels of fear, anxiety, and just overall stress. And that could certainly negatively affect recovery, and that process of recovery. So talking about that early intervention, SLPs getting in sooner, Karen, you mentioned we really need to look at what is the most effective means of communication for them. Mm-hmm. So do you mind the two of you talking a little bit about what are some of the options for communication that maybe both for verbal or nonverbal patients, if it's an oral means of communication or a non-oral means of communication, can you highlight just a few options that we have that we can use with patients?
Absolutely. And this sort of brings me back to my roots, because I spent a tremendous amount of time working in the AUGCOM world, and it started with this population. So certainly our primary goal as far as communication goes is that we want to keep air flowing through the glottis. And certainly that is always our primary goal. But as Karen pointed out early on, especially for those patients, the intubated patients and those patients that where we can't achieve airflow, we need to be able to provide them with non-oral communication means. So as Karen said initially, 100% most important thing is a call system, an alerting system, and we worked very closely with our OT colleagues, sort of establishing a method, because every patient gets the same call buzzer with, the button, the red button that you have to push, on our new beds in our institution, it's sort of on this bedside tool that, has a bunch of different buttons, but inevitably many of our patients can't push the button. So establishing a call system, and we would give patients switches connected to buzzers. We had pneumatic switches where they would just use a sip and puff, or a puff even for a patient that didn't have any upper airway flow, but could just sort of blow into the straw, and it pneumatically would hook up to the nursing call system. So that's important. And then, of course, establishing a reliable response communication system. We can understand so much if we could establish a reliable yes-no response. It makes me think a lot about, I remember a patient, and I'll never forget this. There was a patient in our ICU who was quite alert and was responding to questions, nodding very appropriately, responding to questions in a yes and no fashion. And so when I was called to the bedside to do sort of an assessment and to see what the patient's candidacy for oral, actually they asked, can this person communicate verbally? First I wanted to see what the patient's reliability was with that head. It was shaking his head, yes and no. And when I realized that the patient was just randomly shaking his head to questions, I brought the medical team over, because I said, we're making a lot of decisions based on his responses, and I want to show you that he's actually not responding accurately. And so I started off by asking, Mr. Jones, are you in a movie theater? And he responded, yes. And so, you know, it was trying to illustrate to the team that establishing a reliable communication system, even just yes, no, is fundamental. But certainly remembering the impact of delirium, as Karen pointed out, hugely important. And then as we think about non-oral communication methods, and we wrote about all of these options, just providing a writing tool or providing picture communication boards. There are so many commercially available communication boards in different languages that we can provide to our patient. Eye gaze systems. One of the reasons I developed the iLink 2 communication board so that patients could spell novel messages using eye gaze was actually because of our trach event population, who were many of which were quadriplegic and needed to be able to communicate novel messages. So using a very simple non-electronic device like that would be helpful. Buchelman and Miranda, I think it was back in 2013, it was a number of years ago, they actually provided a list in one of their textbooks and said, this is a list of all comm systems that every ICU setting should have. And we certainly sort of followed suit and provided many of these things like whiteboards and double-sided tape and, like I said, different communication boards and letter boards for scanning, so that if a patient can't point, but you can scan, is the first letter of the word you want to spell A through G and scanning through the alphabet, or certainly eye gaze systems. So those are all examples, Kristen, of non-oral systems. And that might be the process that we start with, but we are, as I said earlier, our goal is to move into oral communication. We want to facilitate airflow through the glottis, and we do so with cuff deflation. And that can take time. It's not uncommon for us to see a medically compromised ventilator dependent patient who cannot tolerate full cuff deflation right away. And so our treatment goal may be that the patient will tolerate 2 cc's of air removed from that tracheostomy tube cuff to start to allow that patient to tolerate some upper airway flow. But the eventual goal, of course, is full cuff deflation, with the hope that then speaking valve placement, certainly for our ventilator-dependent patient, putting a passimir speaking valve in line, or for a tracheostomized patient. I mean, we would often see patients that would come in, transferred, come in, and they'd have a full cuff inflated and they were trached. And so we'd look at these patients and say, well, why does this patient have an inflated cuff and they're tracheostomized? And so the team might have said, well, they don't have a good cough. And so the education begins, because we can't work on cough if we don't have airflow. So that's kind of how we think about oral communication. And I think the other thing probably to mention, Kristen, is to think about how to facilitate airflow in the tracheostomized patients, because sometimes the size of the tracheostomy tube itself is actually too large. And so the role of the speech pathologist includes having a discussion with the team to help them see that our goal is to get upper airway flow. I see that this 86-pound elderly woman has a size 8 tracheostomy tube in place. And so we were able to fully deflate the cuff, but we, with auscultation, hear that there is no airflow going up to the upper airway. And so having that discussion with the medical team about tracheostomy tube downsizing, or in some cases, even discussing the pros and cons of a fenestrated tracheostomy tube. And then, of course, if somebody absolutely cannot tolerate cuff deflation, we have new tracheostomy tubes that are available, talking tracheostomy tube like the Blum trach tube, that will allow upper airway flow in the presence of cuff inflation. So it's important for the speech pathologist to be aware of what our different options are. We actually wrote some case studies, just smattered them throughout the book, just to illustrate how we brought a patient from the early ICU days when they were non-oral communicators through the whole recovery trajectory when they became full oral communicators. So hopefully people will find that helpful as a learning tool.
Those are all such great points. Thank you. Kristen, you know, one thing we were talking about too, when we're doing all of this intervention that Marta just described for us, we're part of that team. We're working under the order and with parameters supplied very often by an ICU physician, and we're monitoring our patients. Mm-hmm. Marta and I were talking earlier, the importance of speech language pathologists feeling comfortable interpreting, you know, these basic clinical monitoring tools. And they would include pulse oximetry, capnography to understand how well your patient is ventilating. Does our intervention change their ventilation in either a positive or perhaps a slightly adverse way? Does it stress them a little too much? Measuring transtracheal pressure can be a great way. Marta was talking about the size of the tracheostomy tube to know if it's safe. Are we going to get enough airflow around the tracheostomy tube to put the passimura valve on in this acute care setting? So we can be up there and offering some cuff deflation, maybe even a brief speaking valve placement, let the patient communicate with the medical team, with the family, get the airflow going, reducing the anxiety and the psychosis. Let the patient ask a few questions. Where am I? What happened to me? And start to participate with the team. And that can just be so crucial. And those monitoring tools allow us to do all of these special interventions safely.
As Karen is saying that, it's making me think, you know, one of the other populations, groups of people that we probably don't even think about, but yet potentially we do have a role in. We mentioned it briefly in the text, but I think it's worth highlighting here is in the early intervention with this population, we may have patients that are actually in coma or minimally conscious with a tracheostomy. And these patients often get overlooked, but might be able to benefit from our intervention as we help them maybe help restore some upper airway flow so that we can reduce the later risks of laryngeal disuse syndrome, right? And then allowing them to potentially benefit from the process of weaning. So we often don't think about that population, but I think it's worth mentioning because we have had patients that were minimally conscious, could not participate in traditional oral communication methods, but yet we were allowed to intervene with these patients. We worked on cuff deflation, even speaking valve placement with very, very conscientious monitoring because they couldn't participate in sort of traditional, let me hear your voice. I want you to blow out. Right, we can't do that. But we were able to actually wean some of these patients from the tracheostomy who are not going to be able to participate in the traditional way that we think about it.
Well, right. Since you mentioned that patient population, I will share very quickly for the listeners. We actually had first season in 2021, we had an episode that was focused on disorders of consciousness. And we talked with a couple of therapists out of Texas who work with that patient population. And the entire episode is dedicated to kind of how to get started with them and how to address and work on weaning and use of a speaking valve and different aspects. And we also have an article published in our issues of Aerodigestive Help on the same topic that they contributed because they're very focused on that patient population. So we do have a couple of resources.
That's great.
That's really great. Yeah, that's really great. We included a sort of an algorithm in the text that looks at weaning and the parameters involved. And so those patients we thought about those patients in that process because they may not be able to participate in the sort of traditional voicing and all of that, but certainly we have a role. We have a role.
Well, your comment that you just made is going to kind of push us into the last question that I had for y'all today, but you mentioned that about weaning. And one of the questions that comes up a lot that we get is, oh, but don't they have to be eating before they wean? Or they have to show they can swallow before we decannulate them. And so can we talk about that just a little bit about the role of swallowing and respiratory function, you know, what are the considerations when it comes to weaning, assessment, treatment? You know, what are the things we need to be looking at when we're looking at swallowing with these patients who have respiratory compromise and may have a tracheostomy, and, you know, we're looking at that potential of weaning?
Sure. Absolutely. Well, I'm going to back us up a little bit, Kristen, because to your point, we'd like to talk about first, before we go to the tracheostomy, or perhaps the patient will never have a tracheostomy, but you're coming into a situation where you have a patient with significant respiratory compromise, perhaps impaired cough, high, requiring some type of support. I think, and this is something I feel I learned so much from my respiratory colleagues, that it's so important to understand the level of support your patient is receiving. You can review your medical record, but when you, of course, and look at your orders, but when you walk in the room, what do you see? Do you see a patient receiving nasal cannula oxygen? And you can have these different flow rates of oxygen. So we see there that the patient is receiving a nasal cannula and some oxygen support. Or the next level might be, and we're just like in a little bit of a hierarchy, perhaps it's high flow nasal cannula. So they're receiving both flow to stent open the airway a little bit and oxygen. So we've bumped up the support a bit. And what is the percentage of oxygen and how high is their flow? Again, not necessarily arbitrary cutoffs. Sometimes it's very natural to say, well, at what point can I do my swallow evaluation? If they're on this much oxygen, is it okay? Again, it's very individual, and we'll talk about that. Or do we see a patient who's receiving either CPAP or BiPAP and it's 24/7, receiving AVAP, another level of non-invasive it's ventilator support. Your patient is essentially receiving ventilator support, but they don't have a tracheostomy. And there's multiple reasons that may be happening. The patient's being ventilated through the face mask, or they're receiving 100% oxygen through a face mask. And we walk in the room and the question is, do you think the patient can eat functionally? And I know we're not trying to make it sound simplistic, but sometimes we're the people that have the best understanding of what this patient is going to need to do to functionally get through an entire meal safely versus being able to maintain their adequate ventilation. So that is one of the primary things that is our role, understanding how much support your patient is receiving and why they need it. When we can do that, we can start to ask a few questions. Well, is it possible we could take them off the BiPAP for an hour or so we can really try to evaluate their swallowing? We could try that and put them just on some oxygen support through nasal cannula. But can they do that? Are they going to dangerously desaturate, or are they going to fatigue so quickly? Because now their work of breathing may increase dramatically because we're basically asking them to breathe on their own. So sometimes that might be a process. We might not be able to accomplish this in one day. And we've got to work with the team to say, hey guys, you have to realize this was a chronically ill patient who had an acute exacerbation of an underlying lung disease. I don't think you can ask him to go from BiPAP 24/7 to oxygen support enough to get through a functional meal. So what can they do? Is there a little better way to give them some nutritional support at that time? Or can we start working with respiratory and our medical professionals, our medical colleagues, to wean them down from those levels of respiratory support?
Would you mind, for the listeners, just defining quickly BiPAP and AVAPs, just so that we make sure everyone's on the same page?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So BiPAP, known as it's bi-level ventilation, is a method of non-invasive mechanical ventilation. It provides the patient with an inspiratory pressure as well as an expiratory pressure. So it's a variation of CPAP, which some of us are familiar with when we work with our ventilator-dependent patients, which is continuous positive airway pressure, stenting our airways open. But the patient on CPAP is doing all the work of respiration on their own. They can breathe on their own, but we are keeping their airways open and usually providing them with a little bit of oxygen. BiPAP goes another step, and it can help ventilate the patient because it's giving you inspiratory pressure and expiratory pressure. Something that we are seeing more of is called AVAP, which is an automatic delivery of not only inspiratory and expiratory pressure, but it gives a fixed tidal volume. It can provide the patient with a good tidal volume. So you are very close to being on, you are on a ventilator at that point, do not have an artificial airway. And these are always delivered through variations on usually, not usually nasal masks. For that type of non-invasive ventilatory support, you require a face mask covering both the nose and the mouth.
Well, thank you. I just want to make sure everyone's on the same page as they listen to you talking about the options with these patients. So thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think more and more we're going to be seeing these different levels of support as the team understands who we can help with and that these patients do need assistance.
But that was actually really new for us, right, Karen? I mean, we, in the second edition, we never really talked about the details of non-invasive management. And so we dedicated a tremendous amount of time really talking and helping the clinician understand the various levels of support non-invasively that a patient may receive either before invasive management, like going forward to becoming tracheostomized, or just giving them non-invasive support until they get better.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Well, we're hoping that people will find that valuable, kind of trying to go through that hierarchy. So let's just segue now to the patients who are receiving invasive airway management. So our trach and ventilator population from the beginning, for Mart and I, we've advocated that one of the main considerations is restoring a more normalized system. So we want to restore a more normalized system to the patient. What do we mean by that? When our patients are tracheostomized and ventilator dependent, most of them, especially on ventilators, have inflated tracheostomy tube cuffs, the purpose of which is to ensure adequate ventilation, that they are receiving what the ventilator is delivering to them and it's not leaking up the upper airway. Immediately, we know we have a loss of not only upper airway flow to retain adequate cough and communication, but just the ability of the patient to use that air for an effective swallow for airway clearance techniques. For example, if you are working with your patient and you know that you've identified perhaps on a instrumental assessment that an intermittent cough and throat clear while eating and drinking can be helpful, keeping penetrated material out of the airway. If your patient has the inflated cuff, they can't use that strategy. In what we had usually advocated doing was very quickly being in there early, assessing the patient, restoring upper airway flow, very often with the placement when we could of a passimure speaking valve in line, then doing our instrumental assessment and beginning oral feeding. They could be on very high levels of ventilatory support at this point, and the patient was starting to eat. It didn't interfere with the weaning process. The pulmonologist would come in and subsequently say, this patient's doing well, they're stable, they don't have any acute infection, I'm going to begin the weaning process. So all of this was kind of happening simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And it not only did we all work well together in accomplishing all these goals, but I think it also helped the patients recover faster and move through their rehabilitation. I know it's not uncommon to hear that people are called kind of late in the game to come in and assess swallowing, sometimes even after the patient is decannulated. And right. What we'd like to say, yeah, I wish you had that tracheostomy tube in place because you don't have a great cough. And now I got to work on your cough to make sure you can clear this stuff from your airway. And last week I could have suctioned it out, put a passimure valve on you to help you communicate and swallow. And I could have suctioned out the aspirated material. So far from wanting to wait to do things, we want to work simultaneously. And it does bring me back to working with the team, our respiratory care professionals, our nurses, and our physicians, among others.
Yeah. You bring up when you say simultaneously, because oftentimes people think it has to be in a certain sequence. Like you have to do this first and then this, like you have to start the weaning or wean them completely before you can use a valve or before you can look at swallowing. And the simultaneous is key. And that does progress the patient faster. And the research has supported that.
Yeah, I was just going to say the literature has really allowed us to share with our colleagues that this work at the same time gets our patients out faster. They recover faster. They improve more. So 100%, it really is about, and we used to think, I mean, you know, candidly, I think in the early days when Karen and I started sort of talking about managing trach and vent individuals, we did think, I think, in that way that first we'll do this, then we'll do that. And then we learned very quickly that it didn't, that we weren't really helping the patient as much. So yes, that simultaneous intervention and collaboration is really essential.
Absolutely. And again, Kristen, we would also emphasize that when we're doing this type of work, we've got our monitoring systems in place. We know exactly what's going on with our patient's ventilation. We know we're not stressing them too much. We're helping them work, but we're not increasing their work of breathing to the point where they will be in discomfort or they could have an adverse event.
I think those are all really, really good points. And unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time, but before we stop, do you have any last thoughts or words of wisdom that either of you wants to share with people who might work with patients with tracheostomies? Is there anything, you know, you want to leave everybody with?
I guess the thing that comes to mind is that if you want to make a significant impact on a patient population, this is the one that really you can make a huge impact in. These patients are so medically compromised and fragile, and the opportunity and the privilege of working with this population at the very early stage of their disease condition, and then partnering with them along with the team to move them through the continuum of disability is really an incredible opportunity. And not to be afraid of it, not to be afraid of these patients, but to use the research to guide your care. Hopefully our work has allowed clinicians to feel a little bit more confident because we've written everything we write is coming from the clinician's experience. And so we really love this population, and we hope that we've helped clinicians sort of secure some confidence in working with them.
Yeah, perfect, Marta. Yes. I think we just want to continue to empower people, Kristen. I think, you know, all of your work, your company's work, Passimura has done that too. Give support to clinicians. And we know that you know what you know, and you know a lot, and you know so much about the airway and so much about the patient's abilities and what they can achieve, that we can just be such a crucial player in the care of these patients.
I agree. Well, I really appreciate your time. I want to thank both Karen Dykman and Marta Kazanjian, authors of Communication and Swallowing Management of the Tracheostomized and Ventilator Dependent Individuals, third edition. I want to thank both of you for joining and talking with me. I think the podcast will provide a lot of great information to everyone. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passimura.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.